Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. This is Dick Staub, your host. I want to thank you for joining us tonight at the Kindling's Muse on a beautiful evening here in the intersection of Ballard and Fremont, center of the known universe in Seattle, Washington, where we are going to have a most interesting conversation tonight, and glad to have each of you in the live audience and looking forward to your comments and questions soon in this evening. We start with a very simple question tonight. Are you working more and enjoying life less? Oh, breathe a sigh of relief, those of you that have been working hard. I remember in the late 90s or in the mid-90s, I interviewed Juliette Shore, who wrote a book called The Overworked American. And among other things in that book, I remember the point she made that the typical American worker puts in 9 weeks more on the job than his or her European counterpart. We have some statistics tonight from a recent survey that showed that more than half of Americans, 52%, say they would be willing to trade a day off a week for a day's pay a week. They say they'd accept a pay cut to have more free time. 21% say they want more free time to spend with their families. 20% said that they genuinely need to feel less pressure and stress in their lives. 4 in 5 Americans say they wish they had more time with their families. And 73% said that they feel pressured to spend too much money in life. We're working more and enjoying it less in America, and we're going to have an interesting conversation about that tonight. A recent report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research reveals that the U.S. lags behind all the other industrialized countries in terms of vacation time for workers. About 1/4 of American workers have no vacation time at all. So this is an important subject. As a matter of fact, John Schmidt, I think it is, from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, said that this is one of the most important ideological issues that we have dealt with in the last 30 years. That Americans have been persuaded that we're not rich enough, we're incredibly rich, getting richer every year, and we have plenty of resources to pay adequate wages, pensions, health insurance, and vacations, but we've chosen to give that money to the top 5%. Going to be an interesting evening tonight. We're talking about mandatory time off, vacation, working less, enjoying life more. We're joined by John DeGraff. He is a documentary filmmaker with PBS. He's co-author of the bestseller Affluenza, The All-Consuming Epidemic. He's the executive director of Take Back Your Time campaign, which, among other things, is working for a national law guaranteeing paid vacations in the U.S. He has also recently edited a book, Take Back Your Time. We're also joined by Dr. Rob McKenna. He's the chair of the Department of Industrial Organizational Psychology at Seattle Pacific University. He's worked as an organizational development consultant in the areas of leadership development, executive coaching, organizational change. His clients have included both for-profit and not-for-profit organizations such as the Boeing Company, Microsoft, Foster Farms, the United Way, a variety of other denominations and universities, and he has a book that is due to come out soon, Dying to Lead, Calculating the Cost of Your Leadership. And we're also joined by the lovely Jenny Spohr, who's the producer of The Kindling's Muse, an ordained Presbyterian clergyman.
Thanks. We're going to say little
Presbyterian
slip
like
there.
Earl Palmer says Presbyterian. But good friend of mine, by the way. Jenny is always good on all of these subjects. We're glad to welcome her as well. John, I want to get started with you. And by the way, let's have a round of applause for each of our guests tonight. John, what problem are we trying to solve? What is this issue of vacation and mandatory vacation? What do you think's wrong with our current system?
Well, we're really looking at a society in which people have been overworking to a very high degree with terrific costs for our health, for our family and community life, in some ways also for our environment. But let's look at health, for example. We spend some $7,000 a year per person on health care in the United States. By the year 2017, we'll be spending $1 out of every $5 in this economy on health care. We spend twice as much, pretty much, about twice as much as any other industrial country, and we have the poorest health in the industrial world. We have the worst longevity, lowest, you know, shortest lives. We have the worst infant mortality, maternal mortality. Our kids perform the poorest on tests of fitness. We have the most chronic illness. Since 1980, for example, we have gone from being 11th in the world in longevity to 45th today. And part of this comes from the fact that we are stressed. We're not getting the exercise we need. We're eating fast foods too fast and a lot of junk. And we're doing this kind of stuff because we're pressed for time. And you mentioned the facts. So we have a situation where a quarter of American workers get no paid vacation. This past year, only 14% of American workers took a two-week block off for vacation. Now, why does that matter? It matters because the Framingham Heart Study and other heart studies show that if you don't get a block of time each year, and 2 weeks at least is preferable, and of course in most countries they get way more than that, but if you don't get that, you're about a third more likely if you're male and half again more likely if you're female to have heart disease.
So who's to blame for this terrible problem in America?
Well, I don't want to know if it's a blame thing. We're caught up in a kind of a cultural mores that says that what really matters is producing and consuming. What the economy is for is the gross domestic product. The grosser, the better. I mean, we need to, you know, produce more and more stuff, and that's what we value. And having time to live and all of these things just isn't as important. Now, clearly, corporations and businesses play a role in that because they seem to want to get tighter and tighter about vacation time for people. And we also have an ideology in this country that says, quite simply, we don't mandate anything. We don't regulate these kinds of things relating to people's time. We are the only industrial country in the world that does not require some paid vacation time, the only industrial country in the world that doesn't require also paid holidays. So we have zero. There's zero requirement. And
we've learned government regulation isn't necessary. We have no problem with subprime lending in real estate. I mean, we've learned that regulation is not necessary in our country.
In fact, we believe that it's a hindrance to everything dear, especially the rapid advance of this gross domestic product.
But John Schmidt says from the Center for Economic and Policy Research that this is an ideological victory of the right. That he's making it a political issue.
Political
right has, in fact, had a victory in America by making sure that we don't have mandatory vacation time.
Well, I
think. And you say that there's nobody to blame?
Well, let's put it this way. I think the political right has had a victory when it comes to all kinds of things relating to government regulations, rules, the gap between rich and poor, the cutting of taxes on the richest Americans, and all of that has been a victory. I don't think the political and I think the political right is most likely to oppose any kinds of legislation that would guarantee vacation time for Americans. But I wouldn't say that liberals have made it a priority either.
Okay. Rob McKenna, what are you hearing so far that you're agreeing with, and what are some points where you're not quite so sure that you're on the same page with John?
Well, one thing that you mentioned this at the beginning, Dick, when you said that there's this cultural wave that we're a part of that may be taking us down a certain path. And I think the question for me comes back, and as I think about your comments, John, I don't know that we disagree, but it's more around the issue for me is who is to blame and where does that go? Because one of the things that does come up that you mentioned is that you talk to the average business person and they a lot of times you'll hear two different messages. One is this focus on things that I can control, and then a lot of talk, especially as they get more and more anxious about things like work and life and busyness and the results in their job, and you hear more and more talk about things that are outside of their control. And so my focus tends to be on trying to get people to think about the things that are within their control and also getting to think about some of the core questions around, for the sake of what do you work in the first place? As an example that I wrote a chapter for my book that was titled The Relative Unimportance of Results. And I gave that to a few of my business colleagues to sort of pilot it out there. And I got a lot of really angry reactions from them because they looked at that and they said, you know, that's great, Rob, for you to talk about how, you know, results are secondary. But they said, I don't have a choice about going after results. I have to push myself and work and work and in some cases, you know, detach more and more from other things that matter to me for these results, which of course then made me go write a chapter on choice. Because I started to think, you know, do you not have a choice in the matter about what you will, you know, where you will spend your time? And I think the question is the culture pushing us? Are certain political parties pushing us in a certain direction? Or are we making choices that are equally contributing to that
discussion? If you look at corporate culture, I mean, would it not be true that most American corporations, and this is a question, I'm not trying to bait you here, but really believe in kind of survival of the fittest. It's kind of Darwinian, and the people that are going to succeed are the people that will put in the hours, work hard. I mean, there's built into our system the idea that the harder you work, the longer you work, the more hours you put in, the more available you are for that crisis assignment, the better an employee you are. I mean, we're not a corporate culture that's based on that. We're here to make sure you're happy as an employee. We want to make sure that the working environment is great. That's really not. Now, there's exceptions to what I'm saying, but we're a pretty driven type A kind of corporate culture, aren't we?
Yes. I would say we still are. I think what's going to happen, because all the companies, what they're interested in is what they're calling talent management, or how to identify people out there in the marketplace. Where is the talent? The people that will come in and help us succeed in business over the years to come. You may see a revolution even in the next 5 years because of how quickly things are changing. You look at some of the corporations that are attending to the, you know, the millennial, so they're called generation, who are expecting this. And they're going to be able to make choices about where they go work. And so some of that's probably going to shift very, very quickly because companies are very interested in how are we going to replace this generation of leaders who are retiring.
Yeah.
And people who have set the culture in the way that it is, and it might be changing very quickly.
Well, my experience is that most of my friends who have been very successful in the corporate environment are people who have made the corporation the priority in their life. They've put it kind of ahead of their family. They've put it ahead of their personal life. I was just with a guy in Santa Fe, New Mexico this weekend. I serve on a board with him. He's from a large corporation. And he said, the last time I was here in Santa Fe, I came here on vacation. But basically, I spent my whole day on a phone because I got drawn into a project back at the office that they felt they couldn't get done without me. And so I spent my two-week vacation working, you know. Nice to sit in the sun of Santa Fe and work. But it wasn't really a vacation. Now, Jenny, I wanted you to talk just a bit about kind of a theological casting of this issue. And John, in the book that he edited, Take Back Your Time, has a chapter by a rabbi about the whole idea of Sabbath, the idea of rest, about rhythm, that these are kind of built into the fabric of who we as humans are. What are you hearing in this conversation so far that's raising some kind of theological issues for you?
Well, definitely it is interesting when you think about the workforce and certainly think about myself and, you know, taking vacations and things like that. I think we get wrapped up in a bit of our own self-importance and that work can't happen or the corporation cannot continue if I am not there, you know, this specific week. You know, everything's going to fall apart and I'm going to get fired. I think that's a little bit grandiose in our thinking. And to sort of put it in perspective, the God of the universe rested. You know, and if anybody's more busy or more important, you know, we've got the God of the universe resting. And of course, he doesn't need to rest. We get into those theological things. But that's in the Bible to tell us of these rhythms of our lives, that God has created these days for us to work. And then God has created a day for us to rest and recoup. It's one of the Ten Commandments. I mean, we think, don't murder. Yeah, let's not do that. But we can kind of ignore some of these other commandments. But, you know, it's in the Ten Commandments. I think one of the main reasons it's in there is because we forget about it so much. And we get so wrapped up in our own importance that we're not able to realize that our health and our life are going to be drastically affected if we don't rest.
What do you want to add to that, John?
Well, I agree with what both Rob and Jenny are saying, and that many of us are making the wrong choices, and we're not thinking about this, and we do have choice, and I think many of the bright, young, well-educated kids coming out of the schools and stuff going in will have more opportunity to say, this is what I want. What What I worry about is the people who aren't don't have those choices, who aren't in those kinds of situations. Let me tell you one little quick story. About a year ago, I was in Jacksonville, Florida. I'd been speaking at the University of Florida, and I went to the airport, and my flight was canceled, and I wasn't going to be able to get a flight to Seattle for over a day and a half, and it was early morning, and so I found a cheap chain motel by the airport and just figured I'll hang out there and get some work done and deal with it until I go back to Seattle. And I came to the front desk, and I'm sure this conversation would never have occurred if when the woman said, "How are you?" I'd said, "Fine." But I said, "Well, I'm not very good because my flight was canceled and I can't get home for a day. How are you?" And she said, "Well, I'm not very good either because my vacation was canceled." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she said, for the seventh year in a row. And I said, "Well, what do you mean? Tell me." And she said, "Well, I've worked at this company. I won't say which company it is, but I've worked for this company for 12 years. I have, according to my contract, 2 weeks of paid vacation coming. For the first 5 years, I was always able to take that. Then they cut back staff, and now they tell me they can't let me go." I said, "How can they do that if it's in your contract?" He said, "They can do it because they pay me 2 extra weeks. But," she says, I need, "it's not that I don't need the money. I'm a single mom. I'm working here, you know, as a hotel clerk. I'm not making a whole lot. But I need the time more. I'm going nuts." But she could not do it. And I felt, you know, this woman said this totally stoically as if it was just she didn't. I would have been sobbing. I would have been in tears if I was telling this story. Imagine no vacation for 7 years. This kind of thing is happening to people in the United States. It cannot legally happen to people in any other industrial country in the world.
Now, is there actual data that tells us that people that take vacation are healthier and more productive than people that don't? In other words, can we prove that this would be better for us as humans, or does it just seem kind of intuitively to be true, but we really don't know?
We can prove that we'd be healthier, no question about that. Productivity depends. I mean, in some cases, we can show, particularly people who are in creative professions and things of that sort, that break really allows them, and we see that, and there have been studies that show that. We can't necessarily prove it for everybody, and we can't necessarily prove it for everybody on the assembly line, for example. But health, absolutely, the science is clear.
Anything you guys want to add at this point in reaction to what we've heard so far?
Well, I think John does bring up a good point that some of these companies that are out there do have the two-week vacation. My husband worked for the Department of Justice, and he had the sort of use-it-or-lose-it vacation that if you don't use these 2 weeks, you're going to lose those 2 weeks. But he was sort of trapped in this handcuff of this job. He was a lawyer. There were things due. There were judges scheduling things. And you don't say to a judge, "I have tickets to Hawaii." You show up for a trial. even in these sort of, you know, white collar jobs where you're required to take these vacations, you get to the struggle of roped into your career and you can't get out to take a rest.
Well, this statistic that we had earlier, that the typical American worker puts in 9 weeks more on the job than his or her European counterpart, where does that come from? How can that be true?
Well, it comes from the International Labor Organization, which keeps statistics of how many hours people work. And that's work for full-time workers. That's work for all workers, and some countries like the Netherlands have a lot of people who just work part-time and things. If you look at full-time workers, it's about 200 hours, but that's still a lot. That's still 5 weeks more than American workers work. And countries keep very, very careful statistics about all of this. What makes that the case? Well, number one, you can't join the European Union without guaranteeing every worker in your society at least 4 weeks of paid vacation after the first year on the job.
4 weeks after the first year.
Yeah.
How many of you here got 4 weeks after your first week on the job?
First year.
No, I want it after the first week, John.
Yeah,
after your first year, how many of you got 4 weeks vacation? Okay. Actually, yeah, there's one of you back there. Must work for the Communist Party.
But the average is six. So you take that, and then you take that combination with shorter work weeks, and then you take little things like paid family leave, something that there are only four countries in the world today that do not guarantee at least mothers some paid time off when they have a child. Those four countries are the United States, Papua New Guinea, Liberia, and Swaziland. That's it. In Canada, you get a year.
Interesting. Well, let's not move to Swaziland then. Thank you so much for your comments. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the solution. There are some ideas for solving this problem of overworked Americans. And in a few minutes later, we'll get to the comments of our audience. We're joined tonight by John DeGraff, Dr. Rob McKenna, and Jenny Spohr. We'll be right back. This is Dick Staub back with you. You're listening to the Kindling's Muse live from Hales Ales Brewery and Pub in Seattle, Washington, where we're all totally exhausted, just weary with the discussion of not having any vacation. And actually, over the break, Rob, you were saying something about industrial psychologists actually argue that our transition out of vacation back into the work life, because of the pressures of American work life, are such that it's almost worse than had we not taken a vacation. What's that about?
Well, I think it's actually it's therapists, I think, who know more about than anybody else, because they see people coming back into therapy, taking their 2 weeks and ending up, you know, on the Wednesday after the Sunday they get back, dealing with this transition stress, going back from their 2 weeks away and wherever they took their vacation to this family system, this work system that they're back into, but they don't know how to deal with that. And I think that's one of the challenges, is there is that transition stress in some ways can do away with that vacation piece. But I'm all for more vacation, so don't get me wrong. And I'm all for more respite and Sabbath and that place of rest in our lives. I think that the tension is in that space of how do I create in myself also that space and that time. I was thinking over the last year, I've been trying to create more of that and thinking, where do I have time for it, you know, in my day? And really it comes down to my own choice. And so I have about a 20-minute commute to work. And so I thought, well, what if I actually took that time and turned off all the noise? I mean, it's my drive, so it's not giving up that much. And what if I took that time and spent that time, for example, in prayer? What if I really did that? And it was the most painful process in the world. I love to listen to sports talk, so I'm listening to sports talk every morning, and it was just to turn off the radio, and I had to at some points, it was just this fight with my arm to shut the radio off, and not to call anyone, not to talk anybody about business or work, not to call a friend, and then to spend that time and just say, and it was difficult too, because I didn't know how to pray in the midst of that, you know, so I started off my prayers with kind of a mantra of just sort of, at the beginning it was actually saying, Lord, your will, not mine. Your will, not mine. Your will, not mine. This is literally the mantra in my head that went around and around, and it became so uncomfortable at one point that I actually remember thinking in my prayer, "This is stupid, God. This is a ridiculous prayer." But what was interesting about that process is that I began to feel like every part of my day mattered, because what I had a chance to do in that reflective time was look at my day, whether it was reading emails, making phone calls, doing the most, the silliest, most boring parts of my day, or teaching a class. Suddenly, I think I actually became a little bit more interesting because I went into things with a little bit more purpose around why. I'd answered questions that I kind of knew what was important to me going into those things. And I got to admit, when I was able to make that choice, and it's really difficult. And I have a little bit of guilt because I let go of that at some point. But as soon as I created that vacation space in my drive, if I call it that, a lot of things began to change in my own gut, I guess, around how I functioned on a daily basis.
Well, this thing of technology filling all our spaces, there was just a study out of Britain about a new disease called nomophobia, no mobile phone phobia, the fear of being without your mobile phone. And the fear is that you will lose it, that you will get out of range, or that you will that you will have some other technical problem that means that you can't be reached. And technology, which was supposed to reduce our working life, has in fact made us accessible 24/7. So that if you think about the issue of vacation, I was talking over the break, some of my
best friends who are, you know, type A's or like me, they call themselves recovering workaholics. They don't go on vacation without their cell phone and computer, and as a result, they're accessible the whole time, and they might as well not go on vacation because they're constant. So when we get to the nature of the problem, it sounds like we all have some agreement that this is a problem that in some part anyway is rooted in us and our inability to make good choices. You know, because you and I were talking about an association that you've joked about starting called AHA, which stands for?
American Hypocrites Association.
Yeah, the American Hypocrites Association. Because we're up here tonight talking about the need for vacation and to live rhythm in our lives. I probably never had a time in my life where I have less rhythm than right now. I'm like just totally overcommitted. This is, the government didn't make me do that. The corporation did. I work for myself. I made me do. I need to talk to my boss. You know, my company needs to set some new policy. This is me. So, John, I'm curious because our setup and the stuff in Take Back Your Time and the initiative that you're doing with the government to have mandatory vacation time, it kind of has its assumption that, darn it, if the American government would just do what, you know, the French and the Dutch have done, we'd all be happier in America. I'm not sure that a problem that is rooted in us can be solved by the government, or can it? What's going on there?
Well, this is always an interesting question, and I think we clearly have to work on all fronts. I mean, I think for many of us, the problem is exactly as you said. It's cultural. It's the kind of ingrained sense that we have that allows us to, you know, where we simply don't make the choice. But again, there are millions of Americans who don't have that choice at all and who are not into in doing these kind of endless tasks they do because they love it in some ways the way you do, or some of us like our work. I like my work. But you can like your work too much in some ways and you can get out of balance. People will say to me, well, you know, I love my work, so why does it matter if I work 70 or 80 hours a week? It's not a problem, is it? And I say, well, you know, it's better that you, if you're going to work 70 or 80 hours a week, it's better that you love your work than that you hate it. But what happens if 20 years from now you no longer love that work or what you've done, and you look back and you say, but I never had time to make friends. But I never had time for family. We have got to talk about it.
This regulation issue is, you say that you're concerned about these poor other people who don't love their work like you do, but do we know that they don't love their work?
Sure, because they tell us.
Okay, but then, do you have to?
A woman told me in Florida. Okay, believe me,
but,
she was going crazy.
But once the government regulates it, do you have to take a month off, even if you don't want to?
I don't have to take a month, especially if I'm. But I do. I mean, I do take vacation time. That I, you know, I work too much. I and that's why
I
joke about.
Well, you're a charter member of AHA.
Right, that's right. Right. I'm working on
with
it.
Me.
I'm working
with
on
the co-founders.
But I do take vacation time. I think it's important to me, and it means a lot because I
will
really
burn
out otherwise.
Are you really down for vacation time?
Absolutely. I go backpacking with my son. I go camping. I go out and, you know, I try to get out. And I don't have the cell phone because you can't be reached where I go anyway. So,
yeah,
absolutely.
But you can be reached almost anywhere. There's a guy here tonight, Lyle. I called, Lyle was out on Orcas Island, and we were going to have coffee. And I call him once he's at Orcas to set it up, and his voice sounds really high. And I said, Lyle, why is your voice so high? And he says, well, I'm climbing Turtleback Mountain. He's up on the mountain on Orcas Island, and he's got his cell phone, he's got reception. I mean, this is a problem.
It's getting more to be the case. But, and I don't say I'm perfect about that either. But I do. I mean, I take vacation. I think it's important. And I think what's key here is that that the Europeans and people in other countries who have the legislation do take more time and they do relax more because the culture, even the fact of legislation, says that this is culturally approved. That our society thinks that this matters enough to let me do it, and that's not the case now. And when you
so
have
what are you proposing? What if you got your way, in addition to us all being members of AHA,
what else
would happen?
So what's
the legislative response to this?
Well, what we're proposing is a law that would say that Americans should have 3 weeks of paid vacation.
Why three instead of four?
Well,
you started with people that got 4 weeks after their first year.
Because
now you're already cheating me out of one of my weeks.
Because we're trying to be reasonable.
Reasonable.
We're trying to, you know, we want politicians to actually take this seriously. And if we talk 4 weeks, they're not going to take it seriously. As it is, there are some politicians who are taking it seriously. This legislation will be introduced next year in the Senate. And we could say two, but then most Americans do get two, and so there wouldn't be necessarily an incentive for them. If we said four, it would be, you know, oh, how French of you. So it would be done. It would be like we're all John Kerry, and we would be done just like that. So, you know, so we're saying three.
Okay, so now
and also the Canadians get three, which is, you know, a good
so
one.
We're imitating Canada?
Well, Canada's a good place to start. The Canadians are at least on some of these issues of time,
yeah.
They realize that life needs to be a little more balanced. And the Canadians aren't quite like the Europeans, but they're sort of midway between us and the Europeans.
But if this law was passed and there was 3 weeks mandatory vacation,
yeah,
is it really mandatory? The company can't cancel it? I mean, the woman that she would... get that 3 weeks no matter what?
In Europe, you get fined if you cancel it. The companies actually get fined.
Okay, what would happen to our economy if you did this?
Oh, I think we would be doing better. Frankly, they are. Look at the current situation. Look at the dollar compared to the euro. Look at the situation now in terms of the countries that are considered most competitive. Even the Heritage Foundation, which is known left-wing organization, has rated the countries of the world for their business climates. You know what's number one? Denmark. Now, in Denmark, everybody gets 6 weeks vacation. They pay the highest wages, just the second highest wages in the world. They give people all kinds of things like that. They have a system
that's
working.
Yeah, but that's a small country, very monocultural, blah, blah, blah.
Aha, which makes it harder in some ways because those smaller countries are far more global. What we say is we can't do this because of globalization. Oh my goodness, you know, we're going to move all the jobs to China. We're so globalized. Nonsense. These little countries in Europe have been globalized. They have had the largest portion of their economies dependent on the global economic situation and on trade for a long, long time, and they're doing the best.
Okay, what do you guys say?
One of the things John and I completely agree because I think that you put those things in place in the culture and those requirements, and it does change things. I think it can affect certain pieces of the assumptions that we make. I sat with a group of about 100 senior executives in a big corporation. I spent a day with them. And at the end of the day, what was interesting is that there was a tremendous amount of anxiety because it was a company that was about to lay off thousands. And the anxiety, the way it got exhibited in that group was, I heard for about 4 hours straight, these are people that could change the world. They have enough money at their disposal, enough power to set as much vacation time as they want for their business. And all I heard them talk about for 4 hours straight was all the things that the five things they couldn't control versus the 100 things that they could change tomorrow. And I think it's for me, and by the end of the day, I was actually toying with whether or not I say something about that to them or not, and I did, but to an interesting response. But I think it's a testimony to what's going on in our culture, where the culture is telling us what is appropriate. And we've been victims to that. I think about everything from one of the best examples of this is what's happening with kids' birthday parties. I hate to go there, but I have a 4 and a 6 year old boy, and there is so much pressure in our society, at least in this region, to give presents to all the kids that come to your kids' birthday parties. So my kids went to a birthday party last August, and they came home with a pool. Each of them came home with an inflatable pool. And I thought to myself, and this pressure is actually, you know, my wife and I have this long conversation. I said, I don't want to have the pool. I don't want to give the pool away to other kids. And
I want vacation. I don't want a pool.
But the pressure is then the McKennas are labeled the family on the block that didn't give away the pool at the birthday party. So who wants to go to their house? And I think we face that same thing with this space for ourselves because this back to that idea that I don't have a choice about driving for results. I don't have a choice about how much I work. I don't have a choice about working for this company. There is that mindset there.
You have a mortgage. You have responsibilities. You've got, health insurance. I mean, there's so much wrapped up in this that to say I have a choice.
I could move. I could move. I think there are choices that I have made, and everyone
you
around
like
me
North Dakota
has made.
you want to live on an old farmstead that doesn't
cities.
Have electricity or running water? By the way, anybody listening to North Dakota, I know there's more than that. There's a lot of dirt too. But I mean, we say that we have choices, but once you plug into just about, I mean, in Santa Fe, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, I mean, there's so much space. You'd think property values would be really depressed. They're not. It's really expensive to buy property
Santa
in Albuquerque.
God.
Well, but Santa Fe, all of these places where population is clustering are really expensive. So when you go and say, I have a choice, I choose not to work, you know, that many hours. I mean, you're going to lose your job.
I don't want to sound naive. There's a tension there. I would own that there's a tension there.
There is actually, though, I think if you think about how much money, say, Starbucks, say you work for Starbucks and you're in management at Starbucks, how much money Starbucks has put into training you as an individual. Sure, there might be 200 people lining up for your job, but they're going to have to spend money training that person, getting that person up to speed. A friend of mine had a little boy, and she worked for Starbucks, and she went and asked, you know, if she could work part-time, and they actually worked something out for her because she is a good worker, and they like what she does, and for them to have to train someone else was worse for them and for their bottom line. So there are things that I think we're not bold enough to ask. You don't have to go to the extreme and move to North Dakota, but say, hey, could I work, you know, 4 10-hour a week and have Friday off for thus and such. I think we're afraid to ask those things because we're so afraid that we will get fired, that we will lose our health care. But I think business has a vested interest in us already because they've hired us and trained us and want to keep us on the job as well.
Now, John, I read this, that a paid vacation is a myth. It's an accounting fiction. You continue to draw a paycheck and health care benefits even while you're on vacation, but nobody's going to actually pay you to go on vacation. You're paid for the work you actually do. The money you get on your vacation days is part of your payment for the work you do on the other days. In other words, it's just accounting friction. If we had mandatory 3-week vacation, companies would just adjust our salaries and pay to allow for the fact that we're going to be working 3 weeks less.
Well, they might do that, and what they might do that to some degree. That's true. I mean, but the fact is that least still, particularly those folks on the bottom, a lot of the people who are not getting vacation at all are making the minimum wage. They can't adjust them down. You know, they've got to. And I think that the fact that with work spread out more, there would be more actually upward pressure on wages. This is a kind of a complex thing that you know, the sort of supply and demand in the labor market that we could talk about at length.
But I mean, it's hard to imagine an economy with how many employees are there in America? Would your law, by the way, apply to young small companies as well as large?
Mine would, and here's why. I think that we would be much better with the small companies, and I understand the pain and the difficulty for small companies in doing this. I think it would be much better to help those companies with some kind of tax credits and other benefits. I think we ought to target our tax credit, not just say we're going to give this big tax cut to the richest people in society, and they can hope they will do the right thing. If we're going to do tax credit and breaks, let's give them to the people that we know are doing the right thing and the small businesses when they actually give people vacation time. Why? Because how fair is it to a worker to say, just because you're a worker who is in a firm with 10 employees, you shouldn't get the same thing as a worker in a firm with 50 employees. Why? I don't understand why those workers can't sue for discrimination. Frankly, I don't understand why a worker who doesn't get the Family Leave Act in the United States, which applies to companies with over 50 employees, and can't go into the courts and say, I work for a company with 49 employees, I don't get this right. My neighbor works for one with 51 employees, he or she does get this right. How is that not discrimination?
Well, an imponderable. We're going to take a break, and now we get to the exciting part of the evening where our lovely audience, we'd love to take you home with us, we'd love to take you home, gets to ask their questions and make their comments over our esteemed panelists. This is Dick Staub. You're listening to Killing's Muse. We'll be right back. Well, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, this is Dick Staub, your host, back with you reporting for duty at the peak of my professionalism and enjoying an evening here at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub, and looking forward to our questions from our audience, which is always truly one of the most exciting parts of the evening. And we're going to get started tonight with Liz, and that would be right here. And Liz, what's your question for our esteemed panel tonight?
It seems that endemic in our culture is the tendency to base personal worth on output and production. Is this a problem with our culture, the Protestant work ethic, and or a personal psychological concern? How do we begin to make a transition to valuing full being and engaged living if the fear of diminished worth stands in the way?
Whoa. One of those nights when the question is already better than the whole show. So, that is a great question. Who wants to knock that out of the park?
One soul at a time. I don't. That is an interesting question. I where do I even begin with that? Because it gets down to the question of fundamental change and the way we see things. And I don't know any other way, seriously, than one person at a time. You know, it's funny when you talk about this concept of changing the way we see our work life, whether you're talking about the leaders or individual employees and businesses, I always feel like if you can get through to maybe 5% of the people who hear you at any given time about that idea of fundamental change and the way they see their life, that's probably a good thing. I think the other issue that's there that you were highlighting is that issue of self, of how you see yourself and how much you build into yourself is what's important. And I think it's a big issue in our society because of all the affluence that we see. You know, even if you have a roof over your head in the United States, you're so rich in comparison to the vast majority of the people in the world. And so that has made it more and more difficult. I think the more we have, the more difficult it is to put ourselves aside in many ways. It's not an excuse, but I think it takes something to break through that.
But, you know, it's really at the heart of your question is how do we value what a human life is? And we do in American culture value productivity. And one of the hardest things for me is to talk to a young student who will say something like, well, I'm just not that smart, because they're not doing the best in their class. And they know from a young age that if they're not doing the best in their class, they're not doing a very good job. And that whole idea that your worth and value is tied to your, you know, what you do as opposed to who you are is a huge kind of cultural issue and theological issue. I mean, let's face it, the American Christian culture is based on productivity. You know, who do we want to have speak at events? The pastors of the big churches. You know, who do we want to track and follow? The successful people. And whereas we all know that in our Christian tradition, speaking as a Christian, Jesus was counterintuitive. It was about suffering. It was about serving. It was about loving. It was about sacrificing. It was a whole, that the Sermon on the Mount was a complete inversion of the paradigm of the Roman culture. And yet we are supposedly a nation that's influenced by Christian values, and what we've got is a nation of workaholics and type A behavior and people who base their worth on productivity and Christian ministries who select for their boards people who have been very successful in business, and on and on and on. It's very much a culture that values that productivity. Now, we wouldn't want to argue conversely, though, that there's something wrong with people working hard, would we? There's something wrong with people doing good work. I mean, that's also part of an ethic that we value.
One of the problems that you face is, I think, and I will speak to, I speak primarily to leaders, is that in our business culture, they have a difficult time identifying why they lead, for example. That's a difficult question. It seems like it wouldn't be difficult, but if you ask the typical business person why they lead, the first time you ask the question, what you'll hear is oftentimes business speak. You'll hear this, I believe in the 2015 vision for our organization, and I believe that we're trying to set ourselves up for this and that. And what I'll play with them around is I'll ask them again, without any other comments, why do you lead? And then what happens in that conversation is that people will then begin to make attributions about the question. They'll say, first of all, well, well, Rob, you're either too young to understand why, you know, you're younger than me, or you didn't hear my question, you didn't hear my answer, because you're asking me again. But then if you let it sit long enough, they'll turn it around, they'll begin to think that maybe I don't really know the answer to that question. And so I'll ask them again, you know, why do you lead? And at that point, you hear stories from people that are a little bit different, because you hear stories of people, for example, in the Boeing company. We heard one executive who said, I'm a leader in this company because when I was 10 years old, my sister and I were on the roof of my house, and we built wings out of cardboard, and I wanted to fly. And she pushed me off the roof, and I broke my arm. And then she said, and from that time forward, I wanted to help other people fly. And I think that's back to that question, is we've forgotten why, in some cases, why we work in the first place, for the sake of what we work. And in other places, in our, you know, we don't have any problem with the metrics. You ask them how you know you're being effective on a daily basis. We got metrics, you know, like that goal results orientation that you mentioned, Dick, is out there. But the question underneath that is much more difficult for many business leaders. And I think it would change the answers to the questions around work and life and issues of vacation, too.
Aren't we going to end up having to reconstruct the American self-perception? America is great. America is the leader. America, we as a nation believe we are the most successful nation, and therefore suggesting a change to kind of do what those pesky Europeans are doing. There's very little interest in that, because why would we want to do something for a lesser nation? So there's this perception of America, the whole mystique of America, is wrapped up in being heroic, being the best, being the most productive.
Well, that seems to be believing in a fallacy, though. If we look at what's going on in the world right now, you know, we are going to be superseded by China pretty quickly on many of those demarcations of the best workers and the, you know. So what is it safe to then continue to believe in this false idea of what it really means to be human or not?
John.
Well, I would agree that it seems to me that we need to look carefully at this, because I'm a number cruncher. I have this weird thing that I actually study these kind of indices and statistics from countries around the world. And the fact of the matter is, no matter where you look in the areas of quality of life, social justice, environmental sustainability, the United States ranks pretty near the bottom in virtually any category you look at but in comparison to other industrial countries. So health at the bottom, crime at the bottom, all kinds of insecurity in life. When we look at children's welfare, this is a really interesting one. I mean, Europeans always say, how come you Americans hate children? Why are you so mean to kids? And we say, mean to kids? What do you mean? So, well, look, UNICEF did a study of child welfare, 21 countries, all the EU 15, original EU countries, plus countries like New Zealand, Australia, Canada, Japan, and so forth, found that the United States ranked 20th in the welfare of children, only slightly better than the UK, which was last. When the UK found out it was last, the government almost fell. I mean, there was such an explosion of anger and people being upset in London that they were passing all kinds of things to try to improve their situation for kids. We didn't even blink. It found the last page in our newspapers. We never talked about it. We never seemed to worry that our kids have the poorest health, that they have the most chance of dying young, that they're doing poorly in terms of education. They're doing poorly in a whole number of things. We don't seem to care.
Lyle, your question.
I just scribbled a whole bunch of random ideas here. But one of the things that's always been in my mind, because I was raised in a family that observed the Sabbath, and we've talked about there's a natural rhythm of needing that break, of needing one day and seven off. And yet, those of us that are supposedly observing that, still we go shop on that seventh day, and what do? We're making someone else work. Or we go to a restaurant and we make someone else work. Or we read the paper that was delivered on Sunday morning. Someone else is still working. So we've actually imposed that. Is that part of that aha thing?
Yes. What are your comments?
That's an interesting point, Lyle, and my husband and I have been celebrating the Sabbath as well and talked through these different type of questions. Can we go out to a restaurant if I'm not going to cook some elaborate meal? Because to me that would constitute working. Yeah, aren't we making somebody else unless I just heat up the leftovers? And I think those are things that we need to grapple with, although I think that should not be an excuse for us not to take the break. I mean, the Sunday paper is delivered, so maybe we should read it. There are things that we do need to grapple with, but not use them as an excuse then to not do the right thing, to not start in, you know, as John is saying, in small steps to really learn to take that Sabbath and take those breaks.
You know, what's interesting is I actually lived in New England when they finally decided to repeal the blue laws, which you couldn't be open on Sundays. There were no stores that were open. It was just surreal. And the argument was, it's hurting the economy, we're not competing, and we've all kind of looked at Sunday and all the malls being open and all the activity as a good thing. But in fact, as Lyle said, there is kind of a downside to it in that we don't really have a sense, even if you want to observe that day. It's very difficult to do so. And that's kind of related to what you wanted to talk about, isn't it, Wynn?
Right. I hear this talk about one day. If God set aside just one day for rest, is it still appropriate to take time to take it easy each day after work, if that's possible, to take time just each day to rest rather than stressing ourselves out throughout 6 days a week and then waiting till Sunday till we can relax?
That's a good point. And I think theologically, again, we don't want to get into the sort of pharisaical, well, it says exactly, this. And no, if you're resting on Wednesday, then you're against God's law. That's certainly not the case. But what it does talk about, and seven, for example, is a number in the Bible that talks about completeness and wholeness and is about rhythm. And so I think, yeah, we do need to take breaks every day and decompress if we can. Certainly what Rob was talking about in the car, taking some of these times out. But I really do think that one day a week that you take out, and then also taking vacations, you think of all these festivals and things that the Jews celebrate, and it's part of their law to celebrate and to come together as family and community to celebrate together and to stop working and to live in joy of the Lord. I think those are so important for the rhythm of our lives, for keeping us sane and keeping us fully human, that it really is important to, yes, take those times as well as much time as you can get per day.
I heard I read an interview with Johnny Depp, and I'll never forget this interview. I forget what magazine it was, but they described him as, he came to the interview about 30 minutes late, and the person who had written the article said, he's a fascinating person to interview because when he's with you, everything he does with the intentionality of a cat licking its paw. And that image of him being completely present no matter where he is. And he said there was no pressure for the next meeting, which probably made him late and late and late for all the meetings, subsequent meetings. But it got me thinking, when you think about making this change, I mean, what if everybody in earshot, and I don't want to sound like I'm an idealist, earshot of this podcast were to actually to speak into the lives of the people that they see who are no longer present with them on a daily basis. There's a very large local software company that's around here, and one of the things that I'll say to my friends when they first go there to work is I'll say, the first coffee we have after they've taken the job is I'll say, if I see it, I'll say, you're still present with me. And what's interesting is they're curious about what do you mean by that? And it's a matter of time before 75-80% of the people who go to work there are no longer present with you. And I know how it happens because I know what happens in that business where you go to a meeting, everyone opens their laptop, no one's present anywhere. But having that conversation, every single one of the people I've said that to 6 months, a year later, is still coming back to me and saying, I'm so glad you asked me that question. Am I present today? Am I with you? And I think those moments of rest, even just showing up, emotionally and spiritually in any conversation with somebody, I know it's simplistic, but if someone can speak that truth and just say, are you there? Are you with me? Or do you want to go back to work? Because if you want to go back to work, make that choice and go, because you're not really here anyway.
Whoa. Billy.
can a parallel be drawn between sleep and vacation time regarding health and productivity?
Well, in the sense that we're getting neither, I guess so. one of the things we are finding, the National Sleep Foundation does a lot of studies that Americans are getting less and less sleep, not only adults, but children as well. We are, on average, sleeping about 2 hours less per night than people were in 1900. We're sleeping about 1 hour less per night than people were as recently as 1970. And this is because people simply feel that they have too much to do. And the lack of sleep certainly has some takes some toll on our health, as the lack of vacation does. We just simply think that, and whether it's out of a sense of self-importance and that we've got to do things, or whether it's out of something outside of our control that's telling us we've got to do this if we want to work at all, either reason, we're stressing ourselves out big time.
How does all this stuff compute with the amount of television that people watch and with the amount of time at work spent online at unrelated, you know, activities to work? I mean, if we really, it's just back to whose fault is this? And it seems to me that we are making choices with our use of time. The reason we're not sleeping is because we're staying up and watching American Idol and Survivor, and don't you all miss 24? I mean, yeah, see, there you go. So, I mean, we are making the choices that mean we can't sleep.
Well, as a television producer, I don't necessarily want to defend television, but I think we should look at, actually, it's a sort of a strange thing that, and counterintuitive, I think, that if you look at the countries around the world and how much time people spend watching television, what you find is a very consistent pattern that the longer hours people work in a society, the more time they spend watching TV. So that the longest television viewing hours per year and the longest annual working hours are in countries like the United States, Japan, South Korea, et cetera, et cetera. The shortest working hours and the shortest TV viewing hours are in countries like Norway, the Netherlands, Denmark, and so on forth. Why? Because television is actually an activity people do when they are exhausted. It's easy. You don't, when you have energy, you go out and you actually start doing other things with other people. When you're tired, and I feel the same way, I go home, boy, it's pretty easy to, you know, sit down on the couch and become, you know, suffer from couch potato blight, as I call it.
Okay. Rob.
I do think it's interesting. The first podcast I ever heard was the Affluenza podcast, and interesting to see you here. And I'm partially interested in how the working of the Affluenza ended up in some of this legislation stuff. Specifically, I think that the pressure is in our society to do all that you can do to get by, to make it happen. And I wonder if there's any concern that if folks are given 3 weeks off a year, they're going to use that to do some consulting work on the side. They're going to use this extra time. I mean, lots of businesses have no moonlighting policies because if given the time off, if I can make more money by using more of my time, I'm going to do it. And really, this is an issue of greed and not one of available time off.
Great question.
It is. It's a great question. And it's a question of both. And some people will do that. I think that's true. It's hard to stop that, essentially. But I also think that a lot of people really don't have these kind of opportunities in our society, and we have never said that we value this. And I think even taking this first step to say we think that people ought to have some mandated vacation time. I think of the woman who can't take it at all, the people who don't get that opportunity. She's not going to go moonlight. In fact, what she told me was that she was a Native American, a member of a tribe called the Lumbee in North Carolina, and that what she used to like to do with that two-week vacation that she got was to go to powwows with her friends. She didn't talk about cultural identity or any of those things, but this was something that had that kind of meaning to her. She says, now if I'm lucky, I get to go to a one-day Seminole thing here in Jacksonville, but it's not the same for me. So I think some people will do just what you said, but more people will not, and we will be sending a signal, and we'll have to also have a national dialogue. Part of having legislation is that it will get this country to talk about this. And that's, even if we don't succeed in getting everything we want, we need to have a conversation about this and what it's doing to us.
But this whole thing is coming down to dehumanization, the choices that we're making that are making us less human, and what is the point at which we become so fallen that we're no longer capable of making the best choices that are in our best interest as a society and as human beings. I mean, you know, we're tired, so we watch TV. We watch TV, so we don't talk to each other. We have our technology, so we're instantly and completely accessible to people who aren't in the room, which means we're talking to the people who aren't in the room instead of the people that are in the room. I mean, there's a whole set of behaviors that are really very, very deeply ingrained in American culture and society now that it seems it's very difficult to take a stand and try to move the other direction. Difficult to be known as the family on the block that didn't give away the pools. You know, the McKinnons aren't, you know, who wants to go to their party? They're not going to give us a pool. You know, so it on the one hand, speaking out of a religious conviction, being countercultural is completely consistent with what I understand my faith to be about. But being countercultural in today's American society is probably tougher than ever in certain ways. I mean, I have a friend, Ken Myers, who wrote a book about popular culture and said, you know, it's probably the most sinister threat to people of faith, because if you're thrown in a lion's den or in a fiery furnace, you know that you're in a threatening situation. But if it kind of is dripped into your life little bit by little bit, it has every bit as much potential to destroy you as a human being, but it's much more insidious and subtle. And so, you know, you could argue that that's kind of what has happened in our society. I really am looking forward to this question. Kevin, you wanted to make this comment. It's going to make all of us feel really, really good about being Americans and not Canadians. What's your question?
It's a bit of it's a comment and a cheeky question, I guess, but I'm a youth pastor from Canada. I currently get 5 weeks vacation, and this year I'll be taking a 3-month sabbatical. I think any church in the States will hire me.
Woohoo! So there you have it. You don't work with my friend Bill, do you? Yeah, I'd take a long vacation if I was you too. Just kidding, buddy. Yeah.
And
well.
Your dollar's not worth only 67 cents anymore either. It's a funny thing. You're doing pretty well from what I can tell.
Well, this has been a most interesting conversation. And, man, as so often is the case, we end up with a really serious issue, the solution of which is undoubtedly a whole range of things, from, you know, John suggesting government action. There's no reason why companies couldn't take these kinds of stands if, in fact, they believed that it was in the best interest of their workforce to be rested and have more vacation, et cetera, et cetera. Ultimately, though, it does seem like there's a little bit of a consensus here that for those of us who have the ability to choose, and John has said he's concerned about the people who don't have that freedom, but for those of us who do, there seem to be something kind of deeper going on here that a lot of the responsibility for no vacation and no time off is somehow rests within the darkness of our own souls, which is kind of a bad thing to have to face up to. As always, we'd like to let each of our guests make a final comment to wrap up this evening. And we'll start with Rob, and then Jenny, and then John.
Well, I think one way to think about this also is that we live in a world around us here that where we get to have this conversation. I think in some parts of the world, this would be kind of a ridiculous that we would even be discussing choices around even legislature to give people more opportunities. And I'm not saying that as a general statement, but I do think we are in a great country to be able to make those kinds of choices. The second thing I wanted to mention is that another ironic statement is that I've been gone for the past week and a half from home. And when I agreed to do this and I saw the invitation, I was really excited to come talk with you, Dick, and to be able to have this conversation and spend time with all you great people. And then it got closer to it. I've been gone for a week and a half. And I thought tonight, you know, my kids have not seen me very much.
Yeah.
And so it's a complex issue for us, because this is something that I really wanted to be able to be a part of. And at the same time, when it got, the closer it got, I realized the decisions I had made in the last week and a half that have certainly affected me. And so I'll get home tonight, and my kids will already be asleep, and I'll see them tomorrow morning. But still, there's always that that dance we go through in trying to make those choices. So,
good honesty. Yeah. And what would we have done if you would have canceled at the last minute?
Oh, my goodness. Hopefully, I would still have a job. No. Dick is a very gracious boss.
He's taken over.
Yeah. I actually just got back from a mini vacation myself. I was just down in New Orleans, which is one of my favorite cities. And just a side note, New Orleans is back. So if all of you want to go down there and spend some vacation dollars, it's a great place to be right now. But part of that, we have a lot of dear friends who went through Katrina there. And what I think about when I was looking at the pictures of these houses that had water literally up to the rafters, and a good friend of my husband was in a FEMA trailer for 3 years. She just got out of her FEMA trailer. Okay, these are these horrid things. It's leaking on both ends. And there's this sense that they lost all their choices. They were forced. Everything that was important to them, was really important to them being fully human, but things that they thought were important were taken away from them. And to hear the way that people talk now about how they're living their lives and the way the changes that they've made in their lives to live a more fully human life, to really look at what is important, education, the crime rates, and things of those points that just kind of weren't really thought about or cared much about before have come back. And I think that's part of what's good for the city. But as our friends recover from this tragedy, they're changing their lives to be in more balance, to be in more rhythm, to spend time and go out and eat at these fabulous restaurants and go hear jazz, you know, on a Wednesday night instead of staying home and watching bad TV or working, you know, until 10 o'clock at night. And it's really neat to see a community of people that are doing that. And I think it's a shame that it took a tragedy for people to reevaluate their lives. And that's what I hope tonight, that it won't take a tragedy for us to realize there are some important things that we need to make sacrifices for.
But for those unwilling, you could TiVo bad TV and go to live jazz and then come home and watch bad TV.
You could.
John.
A couple of years ago, I was in Amsterdam, and I was talking to a Dutch professor who studies issues of work-life balance. And she told me about a conversation she had just had with an American manager of a Dutch division of the American company in Amsterdam who had come to Holland 2 years before. And she said she'd asked him, you know, do you notice a difference in the attitudes about work-life balance here in the Netherlands and back in the States? And he said, oh, yes, that dawned on me my second week on the job. She said, well, what happened? She said, well, it was 8:30 on a Friday. And I called my assistant at home, and I said, we've got a big shipment that has to go out on Monday morning, and I need you to call so-and-so at home, and I need you to email so-and-so, and we need to have these things done over the weekend so we can get that shipment out on Monday. And she said, what happened then? She says, well, my assistant said, well, excuse me, sir, but I don't normally work on the weekend, and I don't normally expect to be called at home when I'm not working. What'd you do? He said, well, I said, well, excuse me, but I'm the new manager here, and we're a company that competes in the global economy, and we've got a big shipment that has to go out on Monday morning, and we like employees who are team players. And so what did she say? Well, she got rather demure and assistant-like and said, well, okay, sir, I'll do what you ask, but I have to remind you of a couple things. What's that? So, well, number one, because this is overtime and unscheduled work to be performed between 5 p.m. on Friday and 8 a.m. on Monday, you have to pay me double for it because that's Dutch law. Now, I can use the money, and I didn't have anything planned this week. And she says, but, sir, I'm a team player. What do you think is going to happen if I call those other people at home? They're just going to say, how dare you interrupt my weekend and my family time to tell me I need to do these things concerning work? So, sir, what I'd suggest is that you cool your jets, and we'll come in on Monday morning, and we'll work real hard. We'll get the shipment out. It'll be fine. Trust me. What'd you do? Well, I said, forget it then, and I hung up the phone in frustration, and I stewed all weekend. And then what happened? Well, they came in on Monday morning, and they got all the work done, and things were fine. And what about since then? She says, well, the truth is, it's always kind of worked out like that since then, and she said, I've kind of gotten to like it. He said, you know, the best thing about it is that now even I have a life. And I think this is what the call for vacation time and for more time and all of this is. Whether we're rich or poor, whether we're managers or workers, this is the call to have a life. Thanks.
Well, I'm going to close with a set of suggestions that was advanced by the Massachusetts Council of Churches when they had a national Take Back Your Time Day. And here's some of the things that they suggested you could do with that day. This is completely voluntary, but there's no reason we couldn't actually do these things other days. They said that they were going to take a day to rest body and mind, to reflect on life's deeper meaning, to reconnect with family, friends, and community, to reclaim time, to revive energy for life, to renew their relationship with Jesus Christ, and to recreate balance in their life. Just a few suggestions of what we might do if we turned off the TV, took a little time off, and took back our time. This is Dick Staub. You've been listening to Kindling's Muse. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll look forward to seeing you again next time.